Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, January 21st, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, Orange County's source of talk, alternative radio, and anteater sports. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org, available via podcast on the Stitcher app. More information about the show and about local literary events is available on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. You can also visit our Facebook page or our Twitter page for more information about the show, upcoming shows, or to comment on what you hear. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two writers this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with novelist Siri Hustvedt. But first up, essayist Megan Daum. Megan has been a columnist on the op-ed page of the Los Angeles Times since 2005. She's the author of three previous books, most recently the memoir Life Would Be Perfect If I Lived in That House. Her other books include the novel The Quality of Life Report and the essay collection My Misspent Youth. She has contributed to Public Radio's Morning Edition, Marketplace, and This American Life, and has written for numerous publications, including The New Yorker, Harper's, GQ, Elle, Vogue, Travel and Leisure, Black Book, Harper's Bazaar, The Village Voice, and The New York Times Book Review. Today, we're going to focus on her new collection of original essays, The Unspeakable, and Other Subjects of Discussion, published by FSG. Hi there, Megan, and welcome back to the show.
Hi, Nicole. Good to be with you.
Could you start us off here by introducing the book and characterizing this collection?
Well, the book, it's about a lot of different things, but the overarching theme has to do with these topics that we think of as being unspeakable. I sort of address different taboo subjects, and a lot of them have to do with issues that come up as we get older. I talk a lot about issues around death and dying, issues around family. There's a long essay about my decision not to have children, for example, and that's juxtaposed with volunteer work that I do in the foster care system. And so there's a lot of stuff that we don't really feel comfortable talking about in life, but yet that we all experience, very universal sorts of feelings. And I talk about kind of what it's like to not feel like you're feeling the way you're supposed to feel, if that makes any sense. So that's kind of what the book is about broadly, and then within that, each of the essays, there are 10 essays, and they all kind of touch on different subjects.
Yes, and you really dig in, and in the introduction that you have, you emphasize that these are not confessionals.
No, the word confessional gets used a lot when you're talking about personal writing and essays that use the I narrator. And for me, I think of confession as kind of just, you know, dumping it all out and kind of oversharing and just kind of saying things for the sake of saying them. And as a writer, I'm not really interested in that. I'm interested in offering the reader ideas that have been thought about, kind of a finished meal, as opposed to all the ingredients just kind of, you know, rolled out onto the table. So, everyone kind of defines confessional differently, but I think of myself as an essayist rather than a memoirist. I mean, ultimately, I'm using myself and my experiences as a lens to talk about more universal subjects that exist outside of my own experiences.
Right, and that's funny that you use the meal metaphor, because one of your essays is called On Not Being a Foodie. So
right. I'm not a big cook. I think it's funny because I talk about, you know, I talk about death, and I talk about, you know, some issues around sexuality, and I talk about, a number of class issues and a number of different things. And I think one of the most controversial subjects that I took on is this idea that I hate to cook and that I am not a foodie. And we're in this moment in the culture right now where it's like artisanal this and that and farm to table everything. And there's an incredible amount of snobbery around food. And I'm someone who just like loves the frosting out of the can. And, and I have very, I don't know if it's simple. I have very unsophisticated taste. when it comes to food. I'm an omnivore. I like the good stuff and I like the bad stuff. And so I do talk about that. And I think some people have been quite mystified, if not appalled.
That's funny that that's gotten that much attention when, because you do cover so many emotional topics. And there's one of your essays where you talk about our area, in particular Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Would you introduce that essay to us?
Yeah, it's an essay called Invisible City. And it talks about a lot of the assumptions that we have about Los Angeles and this kind of tension, because there are all these cliches about it being an industry town and the sort of shallowness of Hollywood, and a lot of those are not true, but then it's kind of funny because they do end up getting borne out in various ways. So I talk about moving to the city, and then the piece ends up actually being. I tell the story about going to a party where it ended up being filled with A-list celebrities that I ended up having to play charades with, and it was like a totally surreal experience. And exactly the sort of thing, it's like, that's such a cliche about L.A., and you would think, oh, that never happens, but then it does happen. So there's a kind of paradox there.
Yeah, it was really fun to read, especially because it's really an incredible L.A. story that you tell, and it even stars, or has a cameo with Steve Martin.
I don't want to give too much away, but I had a friendship with Nora Ephron. I was one of the many young women writers that she mentored, and she invited me to a party at her house, and it was, you know, I assumed there would be 100 people there, because otherwise why would she be inviting me? And then it ended up being, you know, there were like 25 people there, and it was Rob Reiner and Steve Martin and Nicole Kidman and Meg Ryan, and it was just sort of like, oh my goodness. I was literally a fly on the wall, and I felt very awkward, and then I sort of had this moment of epiphany where I thought, gosh, I can actually just, you know, no one is talking to me. And it's kind of great, because how many of us have fantasized about being able to kind of, you know, hover above the room and watch, you know, these famous people that we don't even, it's almost like we don't believe they exist in real life, and we can watch them interact. So it was a great evening in the end. And, you know, I say that there are a couple different instances in this book where I have a sort of incredibly intense encounter. I also talk about meeting Joni Mitchell and having dinner with her. And you know, I say, it was such an amazing evening, and the whole time I couldn't wait for it to end so I could go home and talk about it for the rest of my life. And I think that's a feeling that a lot of people have when they're having really sort of amazing, surreal experiences, which is that it's almost too much to take. It's so fantastic that you sort of, that the half-life of the experience is going to be kind of more pleasurable than the actual experience.
I want to come back to just that point, but first, can you give our listeners a taste of the voice of the essays and read to us from Invisible City?
Sure. I'll just read the first couple of pages of Invisible City. Great. And this is the essay about Los Angeles that we were just talking about. It's been more than a decade now since I moved to Los Angeles, and I sometimes feel, as I did back then, vaguely embarrassed about it. The very act of coming here seems like the ultimate cliche. Even if you arrive for the most mundane, non-Hollywood reason, to go to Caltech or to open a dental practice, or because your pharmaceutical sales job has transferred you to Torrance, people will still think you have come to join the industry, or at least make industrial-sized sums of money. People will ask if you run into celebrities in the supermarket. If they're from New York, they will be too cool to ask that question, but not too embarrassed to fall back on the reliable chestnuts. How bad is the air? How much time do you spend in traffic? Have you gotten Botox yet? Chelation therapy? A colonic? How long did it take you to start calling everyone dude? Actually, they might not ask you about chelation therapy. They might not know about it, and neither should you. These refrains aren't offensive as much as boring, too on the nose, as they say in television writers' rooms. They're like equating Texas with cowboy boots, or New Jersey with hirsute wannabe or actual thugs in gold chains. Not that regional stereotypes aren't among the most accurate stereotypes out there. As easy as it is to find surprises in a particular locality, who knew that Salt Lake City voted for Obama over Romney in 2012? The non-surprises usually keep a steadier pace. And this is perhaps more true of Southern California than of most places. From the gag reflex that is the expression La La Land and its cousin, the equally odious SoCal, to the predictable iconography of palm trees and luxury cars and fake boobs and Scientologists and pot dispensaries and illegal immigrants and healers of every possible sort, there are a million obvious things to say about Los Angeles. Many are just plain wrong. For instance, the fallacy that no one reads or is interested in books. It happens that L.A. has more independent bookstores than brainy, twee San Francisco and the Bay Area. But many of those observations are right. There are a shocking number of people here who feel compelled to drive cars that cost more than, say, your average well-appointed suburban house in Dallas. There was for many years in the aughts a yoga teacher beloved in studios throughout the city who made a point of reminding ladies with implants to be mindful of brushing too hard against your mat when moving through Chaturanga. There is a vast amount of real estate in Hollywood owned by a church that believes its members are descended from space aliens. The surreal effects of watching these cliches play out before you in real life and in real time can make your head spin. They can make you feel like the one live person in an animated children's show.
Thank you. That was Megan. Sure. That was Megan Dom reading from her new collection of essays, The Unspeakable. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And so later in that essay, you have a quote that I liked so much. Los Angeles is where I learned that your ability to see is sometimes only as good as your willingness to go unseen. Could you talk some more about coming to that realization about the relationship between those two experiences?
A lot of this sort of stems back from being in your car. I mean, I think about, you know, I also talk about how it's a place where no one can see you crying if you're in your car. Like, sometimes, you know, you sit on the freeway or you see the traffic and you wonder, like, what are all these people thinking about as they sit in their cars? You know, they're just like, you know, every one of them has a story and every one of them is going through something and we're not seeing it. You know, it's not like being in New York where everyone's on the subway and it's more telegraphed. So, yeah, I think that, you know, L.A. is a hard place to visit and a great place to live. And I think that a lot of that is because once you're here long enough, you realize that it's just sort of a normal city and that you can live a normal life and you don't need to kind of participate in this celebrity culture in any way differently than you might be if you lived somewhere else. I mean, it's very much a place of sort of, you know, you entertain in your house and it's very much a home-based place. So, yeah, I think that there's a certain privacy to it that people don't kind of associate with the city right off. And if you can kind of just have a quiet existence there, it might be the key, you know?
Mm. Let's go back to the Joni Mitchell problem and that point that you mentioned earlier, the feeling that you almost couldn't wait for it to end so that you could talk about it.
Right.
What struck me about that comment after I had read the whole collection was thinking about the different essays and especially the final essay with your illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel funny asking you about it because you talk about how hard it is for you to even go back to that period in your life. But was there a moment when you remembered or you realized I'm healthy, I made it through that, and now I have to write about it? Or was there a correlate to like the journey?
Well, I write about everything. So, I shouldn't say that. I write about a lot of things. There are some things I have never written about and probably never will. And I, by definition, can't tell you what they are. But yeah, I mean, just for some background, I had this freak illness in 2010 where I had like flu symptoms and they just got worse and worse. And I ended up eventually having aphasia, which is where you can't access language. And I was becoming very confused and I had my organs were shutting down and I ended up in the hospital and in a coma for about 5 days. And so the essay is called Diary of a Coma. And it kind of, it talks about sort of what went on during that time when I was unconscious with all these people. You know, what I later learned were all these people incredibly worried and having all these experiences around this crisis that I wasn't around for. I woke up and it was like I didn't realize any time had gone by. So I guess to answer your question, the deciding to write about it, I mean, I wrote a couple of columns about it because, you know, I write a column for the LA Times, and I had been in the hospital for 3 weeks, and I missed 3 weeks of the column. And when I came back, I said, oh, I better explain where I've been, because, you know, a lot of people thought I had been laid off because, you know, the LA Times. So I was like, no, not to worry. I was just in a coma. And so I did write a couple of columns sort of explaining what had happened, and it ended up that I had typhus, which is a bacterial virus. This might be too much information, but it was caused by fleas. I had gotten bit by fleas, and I just had a very extreme case of typhus. I wrote those columns, and people were sort of interested. And then as the years went by and I sort of was able to process what had happened, I started thinking about it in different ways. And what really sort of struck me was the way that people expected me to be changed, kind of metaphysically or philosophically from the experience. Like, oh, are you going to be a better person now? Have you learned from this? You almost died. Do you have any great insights? Do you have wisdom? And I really didn't. And I found that I was kind of letting people down. I felt guilty about that. And I also remembered that these were the kinds of demands I was placing on my mother when she had died. In the same year that I actually got sick, she had died about 8 months before I had this illness. And it occurred to me that people becoming very ill or having big crises often have these demands imposed upon them from their friends and people watching them, like they're supposed to have some great epiphany and learn from crisis. And we don't always. And that's one of the major, major things I address in the book is what happens when there is no redemption narrative.
Now, this is a rough transition because that is not a particularly, you know, humorous essay, but your writing generally.
there's some funny. I can't resist. You know, I find a lot of things really funny. So no worries about the transition.
Okay, and you are able to infuse humor, you know, sometimes very subtly, but it's there. And how I'm curious how you use humor in your writing. Is it something that comes out in the first draft, or do you have to go back later and think, oh, I wonder if I can make this funnier, or how does it work for you?
It feels pretty natural. I mean, it's weird because I was really influenced by like Woody Allen's early books of essays and stories, you know, those books from the 70s, like Side Effects and Without Feathers. And, you know, even in high school when I was starting to sort of write in this way, I wrote a lot of things. I wrote everything. But I, when I was writing sort of essays or, I don't know, kind of humorous riffs or first-person pieces, I was really, really influenced by that sort of observational humor and kind of the use of the high-low, like one second you're talking about something sort of erudite and lofty, and then in the next you're making a really sophomoric metaphor or something like that. So I think that I just internalize that, and I bring it to everything. I mean, I can't help it. I really, humorlessness is just profoundly depressing to me. I can't stand people who are humorless. Fortunately, I don't run into them that often. I think it's incredibly important. And I think it's something that I kind of can't help but do. But at the same time, I'm not like a joke writer. Sometimes people say to me, "Oh, do you do stand up? You should do stand up comedy or whatever." And I'm like, "Oh, I can never like think of a joke." But there's always I always kind of see the irony and the humor in things.
Who, you mentioned the Woody Allen, I'm actually not familiar with those writings of his, but mm-hmm. who are some of your favorite essayists, others?
Oh, gosh. I mean, like anyone of my sensibility and generation and gender, I think I was profoundly influenced by Joan Didion. I mean, that's a very obvious answer, and that's I'm not in any way saying that only women are influenced by her, but I think that there is a particular sort of voice and tone and rhythm that she established, in the early 70s, and where she was really starting to write the kinds of pieces that she became famous for. I think that she just presented language in a way that hadn't been done before, and so I think it got very much stuck in people's ears. In a lot of the same ways, actually, that Joni Mitchell did for singer-songwriters. I often compare them. I think that, you know, Joni, not to jump around too much, I'll finish answering your question, but in the same way that Joni Mitchell had alternate tunings and had this, like, a very, very groundbreaking, different way of writing songs, and that ended up influencing generations of singer-songwriters, I think that Joan Didion did the same thing, just with her use of language and the pacing and just the overall sort of mood of her work. So definitely her. You know, I loved the new journalists in the 70s. I loved, you know, Tom Wolfe and Hunter S. Thompson, Nora Ephron. An essayist I absolutely adore is David Rakoff, who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago. And he was just fantastic, really wry, but really, really poignant, while also being quite a sharp social observer.
We're talking to Megan Dunn. Her new essay collection is The Unspeakable. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Megan, I'm afraid we're drawing down on our time, but I'd want to sneak in a couple more questions. I was wondering if you could walk us through your process of writing an essay. Starting with the idea.
You mean drag you through, speaking and screaming, as I stumble along? It really starts with something that I'm kind of chewing on. Like, if there's something that I'm trying to figure out, that will tend to be the germ of an essay. It's really almost like there's this thing I can't get out of my head, and I can't figure out why, and I want to figure out what this is about. Because I don't think of it as an essay as something in which I'm trying to convince people of something. I think of an essay as an invitation for the reader to think alongside me as I try to figure something out. So I don't really think of it as an argument, and that's even the same in the LA Times column. I mean, even though I'm a newspaper columnist, I'm not out to get people to, like, come around to my point of view or convince anyone of anything. I really just want to sort of throw some ideas out and offer a suggestion. I see the essay as a suggestion, like, let's think about it this way. What would that be like? So, yeah, I mean, really it's just kind of like if there's something going on in the culture, if there's something that's interesting or perplexing or confounding and I want to sort of see what it is, that will be the germ of an essay. And then often I will sort of start, you know, like I said, with my own experience, that there's, you know, that is a lens through which to kind of explore these larger issues.
Well, Megan, I'm afraid we're out of time now, but thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure, Nicole. Thank you.
That was Megan Dahm with her new essay collection, The Unspeakable, published by FSG. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with us. Novelist Siri Hustvedt will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available via Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with essayist Megan Daum. Next up, I'll be speaking with novelist Siri Hustvedt. Siri is the author of several previous novels, The Blindfold, The Enchantment of Lily Dahl, What I Loved, and The Summer Without Men, as well as three collections of essays, A Plea for Eros, Mysteries of the Rectangle, Essays on Painting, and Living, Thinking, Looking, as well as the nonfiction work, The Shaking Woman, or A History of My Nerves. What I Loved and The Summer Without Men were international bestsellers. Her work has been shortlisted for numerous awards, including the Femina Etrangere in France, and she is the recipient of the 2012 International Gaborone Prize for Thought and Humanities. Her latest book, The Blazing World, was longlisted for the 2014 Man Booker Prize and is published by Simon & Schuster. It's her first time on the show, and I am so happy to welcome her. Siri, hi there.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you can join us. And so we find on the show that writers do the best job of introducing their books. So could you tell us about The Blazing World to start?
Well, the basic idea of the book is that there is a main character whose name is Harriet Burden, a person now dead when you start writing the book, which is introduced by an editor, who was very disappointed in the reception of her work over the years living in New York in the art world, and she decided to do an experiment. So she hired three men that she called her masks, to show her work for her and see what would happen. And so the book is essentially a compilation of different texts by different people, including Harriet Burden, from her notebooks, about this particular experiment, which she called an experiment not just about gender discrimination in the art world, but looking into what perception is in itself. How do we see things in the world, including art?
Mm. And could you talk some more about the character at the center of the book, Harriet Burden? I'm curious what the inspiration for her was.
Oh, I think there were multiple inspirations for Harry. I also think that I'm deeply interested in emotional resonances. I always think that when I write a book, what I'm looking for is emotional truth, not literal truths or things that coming straight from my autobiography or anything like that, but some emotional truth. And this book is, I think, in some way an exploration of this woman's rage. She is really, really angry. But it's a very pure, almost Greek rage. And I was thinking about Greek tragedies when I wrote it. And also the use of masks in Greek tragedy, masks that aren't so much disguises as revelations of a particular character that the audience can, you know, project onto. So all of that was part of the original inspiration.
Mm. And I've heard you speak also that you have a smell that you start with for a novel. Does that all tie into what you've
just said? Yeah, I think, you know, it's extremely hard to put your finger on what begins a book, but it is something like a smell. It is something, you know, a sensation, a smell, maybe a fleeting image that doesn't go away. And that develops into, you know, a whole novel. It's very strange. But I think this was, I wanted to make a gigantic female character who in a way breaks the mold. And she's physically gigantic. Harry is 6'2". She's big boned. She has gigantic breasts. And I wanted her to be both an intellectual and a very passionate person, also a mother. I wanted her to break through a lot of the stereotypes that we have about women intellectuals, about mothers, about what women are in general.
Now, we're speaking with novelist Siri Hustvedt, and her new novel is The Blazing World. And Since we're on the topic of Harriet, you were going to read to us from one of her notebooks. Would you mind doing that?
Not at all. This is from well into the book, and you will simply get a flavor of the way Harry talks and writes. It's Harriet Burden, Notebook M. I am going to build a house woman. She will have an inside and an outside so that we can walk in and out of her. I am drawing her, drawing and thinking about her form. She must be large, and she must be a difficult woman, but she cannot be a natural horror or a fantasy creature with a vagina dentata. She cannot be a Picasso or a de Kooning monster or Madonna. No either or for this woman. No, she must be true. She must have a head as important as her tail. And there will be characters inside that head, little men and women up to various pursuits. Let them write and sing and play instruments and dance and read very long speeches that put us all to sleep. Let her be my Lady Contemplation in honor of Margaret Cavendish, Duchess of Newcastle, that 17th century monstrosity, female intellectual, author of plays, romances, poems, letters, natural philosophy, and a utopian fiction, The Blazing World. I will call my woman The Blazing World after the Duchess. Mad Madge was an embarrassment, a flamboyant boil on the face of nature. She made a spectacle of herself, allowed once as a visitor to the Royal Society to watch experiments in 1666. The Duchess and all her eccentric glory was duly recorded by Samuel Pepys, who recorded everything. He called her a mad, conceited, ridiculous woman. It was easy. It's still easy. You simply refuse to answer the woman. You don't engage in a dialogue. You let her words or her pictures die. You turn your head away. Centuries pass. The year the first woman was admitted to the Royal Society, 1945. The Duchess sometimes wore men's clothes, vests, and cavalier hats. She bowed rather than curtsied. She was a beardless astonishment, a confusion of roles. Cross-dressers run rampant in Cavendish. How else can a lady gallop into the world? How else can she be heard? She must become a man, or she must leave this world, or she must leave her body, her mean-born body and blaze. The Duchess is a dreamer. Her characters wield their contradictory words like banners. She cannot decide. Polyphony is the only route to understanding, hermaphroditic polyphony. But the ladies always win in her worlds through marriage, beauty, argument, and rank wishful fantasy. Is this not what I want? Look at my work. Look and see how to live. A life in the world or a world in the head, to be seen and recognized outside or to hide and think inside, actor or hermit, which is it? She wanted both, to be inside and outside, to ponder and to leap. She was painfully shy and suffered from melancholia, a drag on her gait. She bragged, she adored her husband. A few sages called her a genius. I am a riot, an opera, a menace. I am Mad Madge, Mad Hatter Harriet, a hideous anomaly who lives at the Heartbreak Hotel near Sunny's Bar on the water in Brooklyn with people straight from the funny papers. I want to blaze and rumble and roar. I want to hide and weep and hold on to my mother. But so do we all.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was novelist Siri Hustvedt reading from her latest novel, The Blazing World. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Wow. Okay, so that was one notebook entry. And as you mentioned before, the organization of the book includes several entries by Harriet, but also by these other people with some connection to her. And I want to talk about the structure, because I believe you said this is your first time working with a multiple point of view within a novel.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, I've always had other characters, but there's been some kind of unified point of view. And what I wanted in this book was the form to echo the theme, which is perception. And when you read the book, you understand that the different characters have very different perceptions on not just Harriet, but on the experiment that she conducts as a whole. You know, so the reader is forced in a way to have her or his own perception about what's going on.
Right. And so it sounds like that structure was clear to you from the very beginning. You never, is that the case?
I never wavered. No, I knew. And I also knew that there would be this editor who would introduce the story, and that the idea of the book was that it was a really a collection of texts put together by this person. We don't know whether it's a man or a woman. I left that intentionally ambiguous. Mm-hmm.
And one of your characters stresses that Harriet's story is not just a feminist parable, but to the extent that it is a feminist story, can you talk about that part of it?
Well, I think, you know, it is still true in our world that that the idea of female genius is a kind of oxymoron. And this character, Harriet, is a kind of a genius. And so she, you know, explodes that idea that, you know, we like our genius as male. We think of the intellect as something masculine and the body as something feminine. And so this was part of the book. Part of my project was to try to tear down some of those destructive oppositions that I think we continue to live with. And a good example, I've used this before, but I think it's a good example. It's a fiction, but if, you know, two people are looking across the room and they see this beautiful young woman in a very sexy dress, you know, she's gorgeous, having some champagne, and one looks at the other and says, "You mean that beautiful babe over there is getting her second postdoctorate in, you know, microbiology at Rockefeller?" You know, we live through our perceptions, and those perceptions are determined by types.
And speaking of the female genius, I'd like to link to your Pan America World Voices talk, which was called Why One Story and Not Another. And in that talk, which is very involved, and you do talk about this book in it, but there was only one man in the audience, it seemed like. What did you make of that gender imbalance? Is there a reason for that?
Well, you know, I find I actually have a kind of a second life, and actually just recently I've received an appointment as a lecturer in psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical School. So I have a double life doing academic and scientific lectures as well as writing novels. And what's fascinating to me is that when I talk about novels or fiction, the audiences are hugely female. When I do a science talk, they're usually dominated by men. Or philosophy, which I've also given lectures in philosophy, then the audience shifts. So what's interesting to me is that especially a woman novelist seems to be doubly feminized, because we think of the arts as kind of a feminine thing to do in the first place. So if a man is writing a novel, he's masculinizing that form, whereas a woman is doubly feminized. And I think there remains a prejudice. I can't tell you how many times men have come up to me and said, you know, asking me to sign a book, "I don't read fiction, but my wife does. Would you sign the book to her?" I always think, where's your wife? You know, why didn't she come? But I think that we have to think through these prejudices about the arts, but also about men and women, in the arts, and how we perceive, you know, what's going on. But you're absolutely right. I think it was almost all women in that audience.
It was almost distracting at one point, because I was like, are there any men? And then, yeah. But let's talk a bit about craft and rules, because you seem to have a strong opinion about them. And would you like to talk about how you feel about them? And then I have a follow-up question.
Sure. You know, Goya, the great Spanish artist, gave a lecture at the Art Academy in Spain, and he said, there are no rules in painting. And I have to say that I agree. I don't think there are any rules in art at all. I think of a novel as an organism that develops according to its own logic. And the few times I've actually have done very little of it, but the few times I've given writing workshops, I'm always stunned by the rote rules that many of the students in the classes seem to have. You know, for example, one of the big ones is show, don't tell. And we say, what do you mean? What's wrong with telling? You can tell. Fairy tales tell. Fairy tales are all telling. Isn't that a form of great literature? I mean, I'm absolutely amazed, and it seems to me that the, you know, especially in American culture, this obsession with how to do it, you know, as if there's some mechanical way to do this, is really misunderstanding the writing process.
And so let's say that someone is blocked, they're in the middle of their story, and then how would you react if they said, well, then what I did was I fell back on my rules and I thought, how can I add conflict? And then if they took that as, you know, a resource for helping them get through being stuck, do you think that's...
I think chances are that they would end up writing a very stiff and unpleasant story. So my advice, actually, for exactly that situation, which happened to me when I was very young, it's not a problem that I, you know, everyone has moments of feeling blocked, not knowing what's going to come next. But the only time I felt severely blocked was when I was in my early 20s. I was writing a lot of poetry, and suddenly everything I wrote just, I'd published some poems, but everything I wrote just was horrible, and I was genuinely blocked. And I asked a poet, actually, and professor friend, I told him about this, and he said, you know, Siri, when I'm blocked, I do automatic writing like the surrealists. You know, just sit down and write whatever the heck comes out of you. And, in fact, I did that. I sat down at the typewriter, and I typed 30 pages in a single night, and I spent the next 2 months editing it into a long prose poem that was published in my first very small, very thin book of poems that I still like a lot.
Wow. And can you give a few more tips about how one would go about that if someone says, okay, I want to try automatic writing? So they sit down.
It really is what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what it does and the reason that it can help with a block is that it's you really don't stop writing and that something else takes hold. In other words, it's a part of the self that is not monitoring the self. In other words, it's just language coming very freely. And of course, this means there'll be a lot of dreck in it. There's probably not a lot of automatic writing that's really wonderful without editing, but it's the surge that counts. And I have to say that in my own books, for me, among the very best passages are those written almost in a trance. And they usually come rather late in a project. You know, suddenly the book is writing itself.
And I'm curious whether you write on a computer or you write by hand.
I edit by hand, but I compose on the computer. In fact, you know, I'm so old, I'm going to be 60 in February, that when I learned to type, and it was quite late, you know, I resisted typing as a sort of like, you know, for secretaries, but I learned to type in graduate school. And the moment I could compose on a typewriter, I felt a distance from my own work, you know, just the type that allowed me a better judgment of what I was doing. So I really loved the distance that type made for me. So the transition from the typewriter to the computer was not really as great as from handwriting to any kind of typed form.
And I have another question about your history. So your first language was Norwegian?
It was.
And does being bilingual influence your writing in any way that you're conscious of?
Scott, Yeah, I've often thought about it. You know, I think perhaps less now, but when I was younger, I always felt that, and I think this is still true, that there's certain rhythms of my first language that live on in my English, that there's something beneath, you know, language that starts very early in our lives, rhythmic connections, say, to your mother or your father. The way we learn language underlies all of our speech and writing. So, yes, to some degree. But I think the greatest advantage of being bilingual for me has been being able to stand outside of one's own language, you know, English or Norwegian, through the other, and to see how perceptions and language are mixed up together in many ways. There are always words in one language that are very difficult to translate into another. So I think that's given me certain insights that I've carried into my own art.
We're talking to novelist Siri Hustvedt. Her most recent novel is The Blazing World. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And Siri, we're drawing down on our time, but before we let you go, do you have any words of advice to offer our writer listeners, in particular those that are struggling to get to the real story that they're trying to tell?
Yeah, I think that the real story only happens in a state of true relaxation. You know, that you cannot be tense and you cannot overthink. You know, that, and also I think one should throw out the rule bag. The other most important thing is to read and read and read and read your brains out, because it's through the voices of others, I think, that we find the story. We find the passionate and urgent story that has to be told, because if the story doesn't have to be told, it isn't worth writing.
Siri, thank you so much for being on the show.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks again.
That was Siri Hustvedt, author of The Blazing World, available now in paperback and published by Simon & Schuster. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be back next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. And stay tuned for Roots and Rhythms with Sister Rue, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.